Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week.
We may not have an overall recession, we're having a rolling recession.
The economy overall looks pretty strong, at least when it comes to jobs.
The financial stories that shape our world.
Three major regional bank failures
sent shockwaves through the banking system.
We're all trying to figure out what to make of generative AI.
Through the eyes of the most influential voices.
Welcome now, Dr. Paul Krugman.
Brian Moynihan of Bank of America.
Deborah Lehr of the Paulson Institute.
Glenn Hubbard of the Columbia Business School.
Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
Making history, and not always in a good way, in the Middle East, in California, in regional banking, and in sports streaming. This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This week, Julian Salisbury of Sixth Street on the surge in alternative investing.
We've seen like a greater interest in investing in private capital.
Former FDIC head Sheila Bair on the continuing struggles of regional banks.
It's really more about commercial real estate than New York Community Bank.
And Jonathan Karp of Simon & Schuster with Pete Stavros of KKR on an iconic publishing house in the hands of private equity.
This idea of broad-based ownership has really energized the company.
It was this unloved gem of a business inside of Paramount.
Living through history can sometimes try the nerves. Global Wall Street this week watched with concern as Israel's fight with Hamas threatened to spill over into the greater region, even as Secretary of State Blinken continued shuttle diplomacy to contain the fighting.
There's still a lot of work to be done, but we continue to believe that an agreement is possible and indeed essential. And we will continue to work relentlessly to achieve it.
California spent much of the week battling rains that were truly historic, causing buildings to slide down mountains in floods of mud. Regional banks took another shot this week as New York Community Bank stock fell to its lowest level in 27 years after it cut its dividend and had its credit rating lowered, leading it to try to clean up its balance sheet.
This is a bank that's very large and has just gone over the $100 billion asset level that is giving it a lot closer regulatory scrutiny.
And the Walt Disney Company announced earnings that beat all expectations and drove the stock up, even as it sought to combine its sports streaming business with that of Fox and Warner Brothers Discovery in what would make sports history.
The purpose of the venture is purely distribution. It's not about procurement of content. So we'll continue to compete with each other for sports rights, just as we always have.
Thursday evening, President Biden made an impromptu appearance at the White House to denounce a special counsel's report that had said there would be no prosecution for misuse of classified documents, but only because no jury would convict an elderly man with a poor memory.
My memory is fine. My memory, take a look at what I've done since I became president. None of you thought I could pass any of the things I got passed. How'd that happen? You know, I guess I just forgot what was going on.
The equity markets responded to an event-packed week by continuing their march upward, with the S&P 500 adding almost 1.4% to close for the first time over 5,000, already putting it over the median point for where the Bloomberg L's think will end up the year. The Nasdaq climbed 2.3%, while the yield on the 10-year also rose some 15 basis points to end at 4.17. To give us his read on where these equities are headed, we welcome back now Scott Cronert, Citi U.S. Equity Strategist. Scott, great to have you back with us. So I guess the basic question is, have they gone far enough? Are we overpriced now in the equity markets? Because they've really marched up.
I'd say valuations are certainly getting to a more stretched level. What we think this really does, though, is put an ongoing burden on a couple of forces. First, we do need to see an ongoing tailwind from a fundamental perspective. Second, we have to keep an eye on 10-year yields, which are around the 4% level, we think send a pretty decent signal for equities. But at this point, it's really the Q4 earnings period that we think is supporting a lot of the action we've seen thus far, and we think it bodes well for the fundamental outlook for the S&P 500 over the course of 2024.
All the talk in your equity area is about those Magnificent Seven, however many you think, six, eight, whatever they are, the Magnificent Seven. Is that likely to broaden out, and are they likely to keep marching on?
Well, okay, so the Big Seven or Magnificent Seven, really it's three this year. There's three of those components that have contributed half of the index gain year to date. We've been arguing that they become more idiosyncratic in their behavior. That's unfolding. Our big theme, though, has been one of broadening beyond the S&P's exposure to just those mega caps, and we are seeing evidence of that as well. So from our perspective, a broadening from a fundamental earnings growth perspective is mission critical to further upside for the S&P, and what we think that does is lend itself to a broadening from a performance perspective across a broader array of sectors.
So you talk about fundamentals. I interpret that as earnings. Tell me about earnings, where we are in earnings, where we're headed in earnings. I mean, you're actually toward the top of the Bloomberg L's in your projection for where we're going to be in earnings this year.
Yeah, we're pretty bullish on the earnings outlook and the fundamental picture for the S&P 500 for sure. And what I would say about that is going into the Q4 reporting period, which obviously sets up for 2024, expectations had come down, and so they're being easily exceeded at this point. Again, something that we had expected. We had also expected that we'd see a downward bias to full year 2024 estimates, and in fact, that had been occurring, but we're now seeing some signs of stabilization. We think the path higher for equities from here begins with fundamentals, and there we're quite constructive on the earnings picture. We're looking for the S&P earnings growth in the 2024 timeframe to be in the neighborhood of 10 to 12%.
When it comes to tech, there's a lot of talk about AI and its effect on productivity and where we're going there. What's your take on AI and how it's going to affect equities?
Well, and the way we've been viewing it is that it's going to affect it in two ways. First, you're going to have that subset of companies that has a direct beneficiary. You can measure either via revenues or earnings. That's a small subset of the mega cap growth cohort that, you know, we've been discussing already. But under the surface, we're looking for AI to lead to productivity enhancements across a broader swath of companies. That's going to be much harder to get one's hands around from a granular perspective, but we expect to see it in margins and profitability.
I'm not sure we call it a fundamental, but what about the election? I mean, I keep hearing that historically, in years where incumbent presidents are running for re-election, whether they win or lose, the markets do well. Do you ascribe to that view?
Yeah, I think the way we're approaching this election is you can throw out historic playbooks. We don't think that a lot of the performance patterns from previous presidential elections will hold out this time. We think there's a different set of issues that need to be contended with, and each of the two candidates, in our view, has some aspects of their policy stance that are not particularly U.S. equity friendly, and so we're going to have to monitor the way their platforms really fall into place over the next several months.
As in so many elections, risks on both sides. Many thanks to Scott Cronert of Citi. It started with private equity engineering the leveraged buyout of RJ Nabisco back in the mid-1980s. But since then, it's gone far beyond leveraged buyouts and far beyond private equity alone, as private credit, real estate, infrastructure, and a range of alternative investment vehicles have blossomed. One of those is Sixth Street Partners, now investing some $75 billion. And we welcome its new co-CIO, Julian Sarsbury. So welcome back to Wall Street Week. Good to have you, Julian.
Great to be here.
So tell me about the move from Goldman to Sixth Street Partners. Not so much about why you personally did it, but what does it represent in your mind about larger trends in Wall Street and in investing?
Yeah, if you go back 20 or 30 years, I would say private equity was a relatively niche area. Private credit was, people didn't really talk about private credit. It was, there was middle market lending going on at banks. Certainly, you had hedge funds out there who may do the odd private loan here and there. Infrastructure really wasn't, you know, on the tip of everybody's tongue. And what you've seen is just this gradual trend over the last 20 or 30 years. As you saw some of the early movers into alternatives back in the 80s and 90s, the endowments and the state pension plans, they were generating tremendous returns from the asset class. This was giving rise to increased allocations towards initially private equity, but then wanting to broaden into other diversifiers. And then subsequently that brought in other capital. So you've seen like a greater interest in investing in private capital, which means the roles for banks has just changed. There's still an incredibly important role for banks to play as a financier, as an intermediary, as an advisor around these given situations. But actually the retention of the risk capital in these deals, whether it's owning the private equity transaction or owning the junior debt tranches, owning the real estate asset, is increasingly just moving into the hands of long-dated private capital that typically, if structured right, has a liability set which is matched against the assets that they're invested in.
We have a tendency in financial media to talk about active investing, passive investing. What about active management and passive management in this sense? We had Tony James on a little while ago, and he said in private equity, it evolves from something that was basically a financial transaction. We'd leverage things up, we could make money, we could flip it. In private equity, increasingly, you have to actually manage the business, make some change to the business, make it more valuable. Are you seeing that with the various vehicles you're looking at, that you are more involved in the business?
Absolutely. I think about there's a continuum of investments that you can make, some which are relatively more passive and some that require very active involvement. And one could say, building a company from scratch or scaling up a platform, control private equity being the most active form of active management. And there's a continuum in between. And I think what you're going to see over time is areas where you're simply an intermediary between capital from a client going into a situation where it's a relatively light touch will be harder to prove value and add value. And if whereas the more actively managed situations, you can really demonstrate to your clients that you're adding value to them, but also you're a better solution provider to the company that you're investing in.
Given what you said, Julian, I'm not going to ask you what categories, private equity versus private credit versus something else, make the most sense, because what you said is it depends. Depends on the problem. We'll use different tools for different purposes. What about sectors? One of the things that we're hearing a lot about right now, for example, is infrastructure. Mm-hmm. You've seen some big deals now in infrastructure with some other investment firms. Is that a real opportunity that you're looking at going forward?
Look, I think it's pretty consensus that there's some like big long-term themes that everybody's spending time on. I'd say infrastructure is one of those because that kind of ties into a number of themes. Digital transformation of the economy, reorienting of the energy infrastructure across the globe, decarbonization. I think the demographic shifts and then also the deglobalization trends that we're seeing with more businesses wanting to not necessarily exit en masse from certain markets, but at least to think more about supply chain certainty and security. And all of those mega trends essentially necessitate infrastructure investment. And that will give rise to tremendous investment opportunities, trillions of dollars that need to be invested in infrastructure in the coming decades.
Okay, thank you so much, Julian. It's really great to have you with us. That's Julian Sosbury of Sixth Street Partners.
Coming up, anticipating a possible Trump rally if he's reelected this fall, we'll talk with Scott Bessent of Key Square Capital Management.
I would say right now, this is a nirvana situation for the market.
That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover. and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
From Silicon Valley to Wall Street, the promise and perils of artificial intelligence are playing out on the world stage. But what will the next phase of AI adoption look like? Which companies, from big tech to startups, will dominate? And where do the risks and unintended consequences lie? I'm Emily Chang. Join me at Bloomberg Tech in San Francisco, May 9th, to answer many of the industry's burning questions, alongside Snap's Evan Spiegel, Xbox President Sarah Bond, OpenAI's Brad Lightcap, top researcher Dr. Fei-Fei Li of Stanford, and many more. More details and just a few tickets left at Bloomberg.com/TechSF.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
If you look at history, election years are always up years. This is going to be a year where the economy muddles along. So as Mary said, interest rates are going to stay down. Stocks are going up. So they're probably, in my view, are going to continue for the balance of the year. If you want to worry about something, I'd start to worry about 1997.
That was Harvey Eisen of Wright Investor Service on Wall Street Week with Louis Rukeyser, anticipating what the presidential election year of 1996 could mean for investors back then. For his thoughts on the 2024 election and what it could mean for Wall Street today, we welcome now Scott Bessent of Key Square Management. Scott, thank you so much for being here. Great to have you.
Good. Thanks for having me.
So you have looked into this. You have an analysis, actually. You're not just picking things out of the air about what you think is going on right now. Let's start with a so-called Trump rally. We had one last time. Back in 2016, you think we're in one right now?
We finance people are simple. In 2016, the market crashed on election eve and then took off for 3-4 weeks after that, you know, had a big run. So, you know, Pavlovian, the investors are anchoring to November 5th, the 2024, on what a Trump win could mean. And, you know, they're generally policy, market-friendly policies.
What are those policies? Are we talking about taxes and regulation mainly?
Yeah, so the Trump tax cuts expire in 2025, so presumably those would be reinstated and extended. Light touch regulation, energy independence, and I think the market thinks under Trump, too, that the international situation would calm down a bit.
Well, talking about international situation, before you talk about geopolitics, what about trade? Because we've had him come out now and say, this is former President Trump saying 10% tariffs across the board. And Robert Lighthizer, his advisor, has written a book that says we'll start at 10% and then just keep ratcheting it up until we eliminate trade deficits.
Right. Well, I have a contrary view or a differentiated view on that. I actually think that they're putting the gun on the table with the notion of not having to fire it. Is, you know, that's how you start a negotiation. You go to the most extreme position, and you know the world's already falling for it. Christine Lagarde came out, president of the ECB, came out last week and said almost assuredly if Donald Trump comes back, he will put tariffs on Europe. So without having done anything, he's in a strong negotiating position.
But do we want tariffs on Europe, or is that going to hurt our economy?
We don't know. So what will tariffs be? Tariffs are inflationary. They tend to strengthen the dollar. But, you know, it's good for domestic industry.
So you say the market is discounting the likelihood or quite distinct possibility that Donald Trump will come back, and we saw it worked well the last time. But also, is the economy getting a little bit of help from the current administration?
Well, my thesis that this is a Trump rally is two parts. So market anchoring on Trump is ahead in the polls, victory November 5th, but Janet Yellen's also looking at that polls. So David, since 1952, the market has never had a down year when an incumbent's running. Never had a down year.
And why is that? Because the economic apparatus in the White House is pumping away. So providing a lot of liquidity, spending a lot of money, releasing a lot of the programs that were passed last year, maybe they've delayed. So, you know, they're trying to reach some kind of crescendo this summer, and the market likes that. So, you know, I would say right now, this is a nirvana situation for the market. Trump's ahead in the polls. Market's anchoring on November 5th, and Yellen sees the same polls, and she's pumping away as hard as she can.
Scott, one of the things I found fascinating in your note was you have a chart in there that basically tracks where the S&P 500 is gaining versus where Trump is versus Biden in the polls, which is pretty stunning. It tends to say the more Trump gets ahead in the polls, the better the market does, and when Biden gets ahead in the polls, it's flat or even a little bit down.
Yep, so that's correct. You know, I did put the normal disclaimers. There are not a lot of episodes, not a lot of observations. You know, there's a lot of serial correlation in there, but directionally, I think it's correct, and the magnitude, as you said, is quite big. The on periods when Trump is up, we've had a cumulative gain of 35%. Periods when Biden's up, it's 3%.
Scott, it's really great to have you on Wall Street. Thank you so much. That's Scott Bessent of Key Square Management.
Regional and community banks, they're important to our financial system, and the United States has more of them than anyone else.
I think the regional banks are very important, extremely important. You know, we have 4,500 banks, which is a lot more than any other country per capita or per dollar of GDP.
As important as they are, regional banks have come under pressure in recent days. First, we had the effects of a dramatic rise in interest rates, leading to the closure of Silicon Valley Bank, Signature Bank, and First Republic Bank.
So breaking news late Sunday, the Treasury Department, the Federal Reserve, and the FDIC said it will wind down Silicon Valley Bank in a way that, quote, Tom, fully protects all depositors. We know the one question everyone was asking themselves over the weekend, where do we bank and do we need to open a new account?
Then came the decline in commercial real estate values, which hit regional banks particularly hard.
Commercial real estate is not a principal risk or a major risk for the very largest banks. It is much more for regional, and really the smaller banks have proportionally a much larger exposure to real estate.
And now we have new capital requirements proposed by the Federal Reserve, which would extend to regional banks not covered before, and that bankers say will curtail lending.
We have, you know, the examinations we have on capital, they do impact our ability to drive competition in the market and help America's businesses grow, expand around the world, grow domestically. And on a level playing field, there's a critical issue here, is that if these rules go through, the U.S. banking system went from being here relative to the European banking capitalization or other countries to here.
Raising questions about the price we'll pay for higher capital requirements.
Raising capital requirements by as much as 20% on an industry that all participants believe is well capitalized is a bad idea in any environment. But it becomes even more problematic with economic uncertainty ahead.
And whether the benefits are worth that price.
I think capital requirements need to be somewhat higher. Now, having said that, I think it's incumbent on the banking agencies to dig into those analyses of optimal capital levels, the trade-off between financial stability and economic growth, and to explain in a way that's accessible not just to experts but to the public why these capital increases are warranted.
And to tell us what we think we know about what's going on with regional banks, as well as those proposed new capital requirements, we welcome back to Wall Street Week Sheila Bair. She's the former head of the FDIC. Sheila, thank you so much for being back on Wall Street Week. Let's start with New York Community Bank, much in the news this week. What do we think we know about what happened there? And is it a one-off, do we think, or does it say something more broadly about regional banks?
Well, no, I think it says something about the commercial real estate markets, especially in urban areas. Office commercial real estate in urban areas is suffering. Some of it's interest rates, some of it's just the transition to remote work and hybrid work is reducing demand for office space and creating high vacancy rates and stress for the landlords. If they have to refinance, about half a trillion is refinancing this year. They're going to have to refinance at higher rates. So that's what's going on. It's really more about commercial real estate than New York Community Bank. They do have significant exposure you know, it seems to me they were under-reserved. They added a lot of to their reserves in their most recent financials, which is a concern, but hopefully they've got it covered now. You know, we changed the rules a while back to require banks to reserve against expected losses on their loans based on a forward-looking through the cycle, looking at all market conditions. And the FDIC put some really good guidance out about this last year, reminding banks that they're supposed to be looking at all market conditions, not just historical performance, which is pretty good. But historically, you didn't have this problem with remote and hybrid work. So, you know, other banks may be under reserve. They'll need to get those reserves up, and that's going to cut into earnings. But hopefully that plus their capital base will be sufficient to get them through this.
Give us your sense about those capital requirements and how they would affect the banks, although things I've read suggest it really falls more on some of the regional banks than on the very big ones.
Yeah. Well, actually, the bulk of the capital increases would fall on the largest banks.
Now, there it's said that the largest banks already have enough reserves, right? That they already have enough capital, is what I've read.
Well, it will increase their regulatory minimum capital requirements. No, for the Basel III endgame, that still will primarily impact the largest banks. And I'm glad you asked this, because those rules really, the impetus for those rules was the great financial crisis, and their primary impact is on market risk and operational risk, not so much credit risk, which is what we're getting into now with commercial real estate. So there will be impacts on the regional banks. They do lower the higher capital requirements to 100 billion and above from 250. So yes, that's going to have an impact. But there's a very, you know, first of all, those rules are far from being finalized, and it'll be many, many years before they actually come into effect when they do. So I think investors are overreacting to the prospect of those rules now. There is not going to be really, for better or worse, there's not going to be any real immediate impact on these banks. There's a very long transition period for them. And again, most of it is actually falling on the largest banks, especially ones with big investment and trading operations.
And the banking industry doesn't seem to like what's been proposed so far. I think it's fair
no,
to say.
That's for sure.
Not a big surprise. And they've pushed back hard. But
yeah, they have.
From where you sit, do they have a point? Because one of the claims is it's going beyond what Basel III actually requires.
There are many things about this proposed rules I don't agree with. And so I think they have legitimate arguments on certain aspects of the rules. I think a larger issue is around complexity. But just, I mean, what they're really just saying, their raw argument is any increase in capital is bad and it's going to hurt us and Main Street, et cetera. And they're, you know, they raise a lot of false arguments. We've heard over and over again. The common one is that it's going to hurt lending. It's going to constrain lending. First of all, these rules primarily impact trading operations and trading and operations, not lending. Actually, in aggregate, capital requirements go down a little bit under those proposed rules for so-called credit risk. So, and even if that was true, well-capitalized banks do a better job of lending through the cycle. You want them to be resilient enough. We've been talking about the situation we have now with commercial real estate. This is going to create increased credit losses on the banking system, and large banks have some exposure here too. Also, as you know, as monetary policy tightens again, you have market law inflated asset valuations adjust, low yielding assets lose market value. So when we get to these cycles, of monetary tightening, we talk about a hard landing. But the way you avoid a hard landing is to make sure the banking system has enough capital to absorb the kinds of losses we're seeing right now, which come with monetary tightening.
Sheila, thank you so much for being back on Wall Street. Always great to have you here. That's Sheila Bair. She is the former chair of the FDIC. Coming up, private equity seeks to breathe new life into the book publishing business. We talk with Pete Stavros of KKR and Simon & Schuster CEO Jonathan Karp.
What's possible if we become the destination of choice for editors?
It is attracting more talent already. We've already been able to hire marquee editors.
That's next on Wall Street Week on Bloomberg.
Today's show is sponsored by Public.com. That's where you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. While we can't say for certain it's the highest interest rate there is, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, a higher rate than Betterment, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover. and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So, if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty damn up there. This is a paid endorsement for Public Investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA, SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosures/high-yield-account.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
This is Bloomberg Wall Street Week with David Westin from Bloomberg Radio.
This is Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. An iconic publishing house has changed hands as Simon & Schuster has been bought by KKR. And we're joined now by the two individuals who've driven this deal. They are the president and CEO of Simon & Schuster. He is Jonathan Karp. And by our friend and colleague from KKR, Pete Stavros. So, Pete, welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Great to have you back and great to have you here, Jonathan.
Thanks.
So Pete, let me start with you. We've talked to you about KKR's theory about acquisitions at this point. Explain why you picked book publishing, because there's a lot of people who think that that's not a great business. It's a wonderful thing, but it's not necessarily a great growth business.
So it's more stable than you might think. So book publishing, the volumes are stable and they've survived the internet, they've survived mobile in a way that a lot of old line media businesses have not and industries have not. If you look at their content library at Simon & Schuster, the company's been around 100 years. They've published everything from The Great Gatsby to Catch-22. You could not replace their content library. Now, on top of that, what gets us excited is it was this unloved gem of a business inside of Paramount. So it did not get an investment. It did not get a lot of attention. And so we looked at it and we said, well, could they do more with audiobooks? What type of operational improvements could there be? You know, Jonathan and I have talked about this. Forecasting demand for a new book is really hard. How many copies of that book are going to be sold is very difficult to predict. We think there's ways to bring a little more science to that and also to shrink our supply chain and be more responsive so we're not producing excess books that end up getting thrown out. Employee engagement. Yeah, there's 1,650 employees at the company. Fewer than 5% had ownership in the company, which is something we're going to bring to the table around employee engagement and ownership. You know, what's possible if we become the destination of choice for editors, you know, who are effectively talent agents for authors? So then we're going to be the destination of choice for authors. And what this could all unleash in now being the only standalone book publishing company out there, this could be a big deal.
So Jonathan, what about from your side of it, from Simon & Schuster's side of it, what does KKR potentially bring to the table? So I understand KKR said they don't want to start picking the books. They don't want to do your job.
Well, I mean, first of all, the idea of giving all of the employees a piece of the action, this idea of broad-based ownership has really energized the company. And I think it's got all of us rowing together. And I think it was a jolt of excitement that went through the company when this was announced. And you know, I really credit Pete with you know, being an advocate and an evangelist for this idea, because it is attracting more talent already. We've already been able to hire some marquee editors, and as Pete said, I mean, those editors are going to attract the authors.
Well, explain that part of the business exactly. I mean, they want to work harder because they have a piece of the action now. If you get those marquee editors, does that bring in authors that will give you hits? Because my understanding is it is still a hit-driven business.
Well, it is a hit-driven business on the front list, but now about half of our sales are coming from backlist, books that have been out for more than a year. And so you want the best editors to attract the books that are going to last. And the books that are lasting are easier and easier to sell because of digital marketing. So it's actually a much better business than it's ever been because we can instantly sell books through ebooks or through audio. The other part of the business that's really, really exciting right now is audiobooks, because Spotify's gotten into the business. Of course, Audible and Apple are already there. But with Spotify getting into the market, our books are reaching an entirely different audience. And when you think about it, only about half of the people in the country will buy a book in a year. But the people who are listening to Spotify, they may be music listeners, they may just be people who aren't really into the habit of reading. Last year when we published the Britney Spears memoir, we set records on Spotify, and we've sold over a million audiobooks of Britney Spears. So that's a very exciting development for the business.
So Pete, you talked about the catalog before, and I was wondering ways to exploit the catalog. It sounds like part of it is new outlets, essentially new forms of media. What are the margins on that though? When you go to a Spotify or something, you can't make as much money off of that as you do off a book, I assume.
I don't think we want to talk about
it. Yeah, we're not going to talk about the margins, but I mean, but the distribution is frictionless. So there are no returns with audiobooks, and there are no returns with ebooks. So it's a better way of getting books out there to the public. And it's also instant. You're always going to be able to find it if you're searching for it digitally. That's certainly not as true when you go to your local bookstore.
That's fascinating. AI, we've talked about AI before. How does that help you with publishing?
Well, it could be a tool to make authors and editors more productive. I mean, just to be clear, what's not going to happen is we're not going to go start writing books with AI. That's something we talked about on the front end. It could be a productivity tool. There's so much that's unknown, so we don't know exactly how it might help us be more productive in the future, but it's something we're thinking about and studying.
It strikes me this is the first time, I think since 1975, Simon Schuster was not owned by a conglomerate. I mean, going all the way back to Gulf and Western, I believe. How does that change your orientation, Jonathan, now that you have somebody who's really focused on book publishing rather than focusing on an awful lot of other businesses?
Well, it is true that KKR is going to allow us to invest more in our own business. So there are several engines that drive our growth. One of them, obviously, the adult books, but also children's books, audio, international, and distribution. We actually distribute books from many other smaller publishers. So those are our five engines of growth. And KKR is going to allow us to invest more in our international distribution and more in attracting other clients to distribute.
Is there more transparency now for people at Simon Schuster about how their business works, about what they're contributing to it, and whether you're succeeding or not succeeding?
Absolutely. We are having quarterly shareholder meetings now. And I have to say, before KKR bought us, I was called into a meeting with two of the principals at KKR, Richard Sarnoff and Ted Oberwager. And before they bought us, they wanted to make sure that I was on board with the idea of broad-based ownership. And they set up a whole special meeting just to talk to me about this. And I was actually quite surprised. I was incredulous, actually, that they would think that any CEO would be opposed to such a thing. But they said that, you know, it is a lot of work. And you have to really communicate with the employees and explain all of this to them. And it actually has been a fair amount of work, but worth it every step of the way. And I really do think that it has really changed the tone at this company.
The pushback we sometimes get from executives, certainly we didn't get this from Jonathan, but sometimes people just say, I'm so overwhelmed with priorities. You know, I already heard you want us to double our earnings. You want our financials by the 15th of the month. You want us to decarbonize, add diversity, and on and on and on. And now you want me to teach financial literacy, drive employee engagement, make everyone an owner. I just can't do it all. And the unlock, and Jonathan got there way earlier than many others, the unlock is if you do those last few things well, then everything else that came before it is a lot easier. If you've got a more stable workforce that's more engaged on the job, has a stake in the outcome, all the other operational initiatives are going to be easier to accomplish.
Do you have a time horizon in your head at KKR about how long you're likely to hold this?
Yeah, we're not in a hurry. So I would say KKR is distinguished in taking our time. We've owned businesses for 20 years before. It takes as long as it takes. Our base case would be this is, you know, 5, 6, 7 years. We've got a bunch of things we want to accomplish. Maybe it becomes a great public company someday. We'll see. But we're not in a hurry.
So 5, 6, 7 years, maybe longer. Over that course, I mean, there are things you'll do behind the scenes, Jonathan, to improve things. What about in terms of the books you publish? What are the categories that you're looking at right now that you think are growth categories in terms of attractiveness of books?
Well, we're getting into the Latino market more. Obviously, almost 20% of the American public is from Latin American background, and that audience hasn't really been reached very well by book publishers. So that's a big one. We're getting more into science fiction and fantasy. We hadn't really been publishing very many books in that category for some reason. We want to be publishing more business books on an international level. I mean, there are so many categories that we're not in right now.
Okay, thank you so much. Jonathan Karp of Simon Schuster and Pete Stavros of KKR.
Finally, one more thought. Former World Bank President Paul Wolfowitz once said about firing employees, that's unfortunately part of doing business. And there's a lot of that sort of business being done these days. Just ask the 3,000 people being laid off at Estee Lauder.
Cutting as much as 3,000 positions. We talk about, we continue to see job cuts. This is part of a restructuring plan to put one of the world's largest beauty companies back on track. Many investors, as we know, would have said this was long in coming.
Or the 32,000 tech employees let go already this year, including 10% of those working at Snap.
Snap saying these cuts are being made to, quote, best position our business to execute on our highest priorities. It's been facing that deceleration in ad revenue, as have many of its tech peers.
Or the 12,000 people in management at UPS who are about to be shown the door.
And what they're really doing is looking at the structure of their networks, you know, whether that is their labor network and then their management ranks. They're looking at their brokerage business. They've decided to put that under strategic review. What it is showing us is that they're taking a hard look at their costs. And, you know, we would probably have to say UPS and some other large transportation companies have gotten fat over the years.
Not even those in the relatively new departments devoted to diversity, equity, and inclusion are immune. As we heard this week, that Zoom is shuttering the entire operation and outsourcing it. As Paul Wolfowitz suggests, there's nothing new in layoffs. They came to my hometown of Flint, Michigan in the 1980s. And before they were done, the auto plants where my father and grandfather had worked were gone.
Flint, Michigan, USA, built cars for General Motors, the world's largest corporation, until Roger Smith, the chairman of General Motors, shut down the assembly lines.
We do not have any plan to cut our workforce.
Closed 11 automobile plants.
This is not a plant closing, it's a loss of one product line.
And laid off 30,000 workers.
He has as much concern about these people as you do.
Anyone who knows business understands that sometimes what they call creative destruction is necessary for broader progress in the economy, in business, and even in the workforce.
You have some jobs that are lost and other jobs that are gained. We had 450,000 telephone operators in this country in the 1950s. You tell me the last time you talked to a telephone operator. We had close to 2 million people, I assume most of them women, classified as typists. That's not even a job category anymore in the BLS. And alternatively, we've developed millions of jobs in technology industries and finance and in other sectors that have actually been helped by the development of technology.
And despite all the layoffs, the U.S. unemployment level remains in an historically low 3.7%. But however necessary and even beneficial these so-called restructurings may be, we should never lose sight of what they mean for those whose lives are being upended.
I came here to let you go.
Pardon me?
I came here to fire you, Jerry.
That does it for this episode of Wall Street Week. I'm David Westin. This is Bloomberg. See you next week.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.